Welcome to Citizens Climate Radio. In this show, we highlight people's stories, we celebrate your successes, and together we share strategies for talking about climate change. I'm your host, Peter Santoscano. Welcome to episode 28 of Citizens Climate Radio, a project of Citizens Climate Education. This episode is airing on Saturday, September 25th, 2018. I'm very excited about our latest puzzler question. If you want practice in climate change storytelling, I encourage you to answer. At the end of the show, I'll share the puzzler question and how you can answer it. In the Art House, we are looking at a work in progress. Dante Flores studies theater at Emerson College in Boston, Massachusetts. He wrote a play that explores family dynamics in a time of accelerated climate change. Dante talks to us about the creative process and the inspiration to set the play during a very important and often contentious U.S. holiday. But first, I speak with two other college students. They are part of a student-led initiative on the University of Delaware campus that started in 2012. Beyond getting students to change individual behaviors, Sophie Phillips and CJ Krulowitz are committed to permanently changing systems on their campus. There is much we can learn about our own climate advocacy from their strategies and methods. This is a story about campus sustainability. It is also about friendship and how to run a successful campaign that may well lead to significant changes. Let me set the scene. 2012. At this point, Sophie and CJ still haven't even graduated from high school, so they do not witness these events. Instead, the story got passed down to them. 2012. It's a beautiful spring day on the University of Delaware campus. Professor McKay Jenkins teaches journalism and environmental humanities. He decides to take his class outdoors. Dab smack in the center of campus is a gorgeous lawn, the green. Here's Sophie.
The green is this giant space that's in the middle of main campus. So if you're going to any of the academic buildings, you have to walk past the green. And it's not only in front of those buildings, but it's also in front of the dorm buildings, both on the north side of campus and on the south side of campus. So you can imagine it's pretty giant and pretty important to the university.
The class settles on the perfectly groomed, pristine lawn, not a weed or even a clover in sight. This class, though, is not the only group enjoying this outdoor public space.
There's kids all the time, little kids that are either part of the university faculty, or you'll have just community members in Newark or in Wilmington come down because it is a really great space to bring your kids to play. Also, a lot of animals we'll see, so mostly dogs out there on the green playing as well.
The green is the focal point for the campus.
There are sometimes protest sort of things going on or awareness things like, they had a bunch of backpacks on the green to represent suicides. During the summer and during the spring months, you'll see slacklining, frisbee, soccer, people just laying out and tanning. You'll literally see thousands of people on the green every single day.
But on this day, in 2012, the students notice an otherworldly looking figure in a full head-to-toe hazmat suit.
And just a few feet away from them, they noticed a worker in full gear spraying a chemical. So full from head to toe, so a chemical couldn't touch their body.
This concerns the students. This environmental studies class turns from the theoretical to a real-world situation.
So they went up to the worker and asked what he was spraying, and he said 2,4-D.
2,4-D is one of the oldest and most widely available herbicides in the world. It's been around since 1945. During World War II, researchers in the US and UK worked on creating new chemical weapons. They discovered the chemical compound dichlorophenoxysaic acid, or 2,4-D. It's easier. It selectively kills some plants without harming some grasses and grains. 2,4-D was one of the ingredients in Agent Orange, which was used during the Vietnam War. Questions as to the negative health effects of 2,4-D abound. The students believed strongly that it was not healthy for them. They grew curious and wanted to know what other chemicals the groundskeepers used on the green. That's when they hit a wall.
Now, it took a lot of emailing, multiple emails after a few weeks of getting no response. Eventually, we'd get a response. They said they'd give it to us or that they didn't have it yet, which didn't make any sense because they were spraying every week. So, of course, they had a chemicals list. But basically, it just took a lot of persistence and sitting outside of the ground committee's doors so they wouldn't be able to leave their office without seeing us. And then eventually, after a year and a half, they gave us the list.
During that year and a half, though, the students kept busy and organized a well-planned strategy to engage their campus. Through the Students for the Environment group, they launched the Green the Green initiative. Their goal? For the University of Delaware to transition to an organic lawn. Their first step was to raise awareness of the issue.
They knew that many of the students and the faculty around the campus didn't know about this, and they wanted to raise awareness. And so the first wave was getting signs on the green, just to show that chemicals were being sprayed at that moment. So the signs are tiny, still to this day, are very, very small, and they say professionally treated. So when students walk by and they sort of see these, they don't really know what it means. So we'll see people immediately after a worker came out and sprayed, sitting with their face full in the grass. It's really upsetting to see. But yeah, so that's kind of how it started.
They also organized protests.
We still have the original signs that they used in our office. A lot of them said, toxic, if you sit on the green, you'll get cancer, things like that that were super surprising, so it would catch people's eye. And it did make a difference.
In fact, they experienced their first success.
So they did get 2,4-D banned, and it's definitely not sprayed on the green anymore.
And they finally got the full list of chemicals used on the lawn.
We saw specifically Roundup and Powerzone and these chemicals that we knew were considered carcinogenic. So our next step was a teach-in. We set up a PowerPoint with the chemicals that were on there and some of their MSDSs and opened it to the public. People would come and we'd get to tell them what was going on, what Green the Green was, raise awareness of just us in general, and then we'd get into what chemicals were being used and why people should be scared about it.
Green the Green decided early on to look at the lawn care problem as a health risk. Sure, lots of people are somewhat sympathetic to the environment, but when they feel an immediate threat to their health or to their family, they really pay attention.
A lot of people get rashes, so they'll have big red bumps all over their body after sitting on the green, sometimes for even just 10 minutes. My friends and I can't stand the green for too long because many of them break out really quickly. We recently got an email from a mom whose three-year-old was playing on the green, and she broke out in a huge rash all over her body after playing on the green for only a couple of hours. So you could see that there are community members that are also worried about what's going on the university's campus as well. Also, the people who are spraying these chemicals. We talked to Paul Tukey, who basically started the lawn care movement. And the reason he did that was because he sprayed chemicals for a long time. And he got really sick and his kid got really sick because he was coming home every day in these clothes that were covered in chemicals. And after that, he did a lot of research and he realized that these chemicals have an effect on children even more than they do adults. So even just bringing your kids on the green or being around it yourself and then bringing it home to your kids is extremely dangerous.
Sophie, now a senior, explains they are not simply seeking to ban harsh chemicals from the lawn. They want to improve the space with a healthier and more environmentally friendly alternative.
Yes, so we didn't want just the chemicals to go away. We wanted there to be an organic program that would take its place because organics is healthy for the environment, it's healthy for the soil, and it's healthy for the people. So we started looking at the best use of organics on something as big as the green. We contacted Paul Tukey, who I mentioned before, basically started the entire organic lawn care movement. And we asked him what the best idea would be for the green and what was important to use and how we can make this successful. So he helped us come up with a program.
And of course, they invited the groundspeople to inform and inspire them. Green the Green also leveraged the media to get the word out.
So we didn't publish anything ourselves, but we got interviewed by a lot of students who were in McKay's class and other humanities or environmental classes. So over the years, since then, we've had, I can't even tell you how many publications about Green the Green. And after the last one, this was last year, we got a lot of people coming up to us and talking to us and realizing that this was an issue. So I was really happy that these students took the initiative to come out and talk to us about it.
They continue to reach out in creative ways.
We made a video and we made a survey. So we sent out the video with a link to the survey, and the survey had questions like, do you know what chemicals are on the green? Would you have a problem with organics being on the green? Do you mind having other grasses in the green, like clovers? Because the aesthetic view of it is very important to grounds. They didn't want any other color in the green because they thought alumni and students wouldn't like it. So we wanted to get that question out there and have that answered and show them that people actually don't really care that much about it. So that was a big thing that we did. And then also we presented at a conference, a national conference, and had a lot of students come up to us after that as well and talk about starting Green the Green at their schools. So we tried to raise awareness in basically any way that we could and tried to get it past campus as well.
The administrators of the grounds must have begun to feel the building pressure. Independently, they set up their own organic test plots. More about that in a moment. CJ Krulowitz is a sophomore. She will take over the Green the Green initiative once Sophie graduates later this school year. Bridging the gap between exiting students with incoming students is critical. And making that happen, first impressions matter.
Me and one of my best friends went in kind of not knowing exactly what to expect. We just went in and we're so welcomed by everyone. It was just such a warm experience going in. And I was able to meet people that just have similar interests to me, the same kind of passion that I do for the environment.
University is the place to discover new ideas and practices. It could be an obscure 19th century philosophy or a trendy, overpriced healthy beverage. For CJ, though, she found a new passion in waste management.
We have like a subcommittee about composting. So I started off really interested in that. Through the Green Committee, I learned more about how compost tea can be used on greens and areas like that that need fertilizer, and how it's just a great component and a substitute for the harsh inorganic fertilizers that are often used.
There is a reason CJ is learning so much about composting. Compost tea is actually taking on a big role in the campaign to Green the Green. Sophie mentioned the groundskeepers started organic test plots.
Without talking to us about what we wanted on there, they just said they were going to do the best organic program that they can think of. And that was wrong. What they did is not going to work because they left out the most important part of organics, which is a liquid component. Without a liquid component, organics will never work. So now on campus, we have these two pilot plots that would be awesome, except they're missing this essential part. So our next goal is to have them redo these pilot plots so they'll be successful in the next couple of years.
Sophie won't be around, though. She's graduating. How is CJ feeling about leading the next wave of students in this Greening the Green movement?
Overwhelming, but I feel like Sophie is the perfect person to kind of teach me where I'm going. We work very well together. She's very good at explaining what's going on, and she has so much knowledge about what's going on, and she's so passionate about it that I think that she'll be able to make sure that I'm perfectly ready to take over for her.
I asked CJ what success looks like. She immediately turned to the test plots.
We are hoping to convince them to use our organic program instead, because I'm sure Sophie started to tell you about this, but there's no liquid component in their program, and so they're pretty much setting themselves up to fail. So what we're hoping to do is convince Grounds to let us take our program and use it either on the original pilot plots or new plots and use the liquid component that we've recommended.
And what about long-term goals?
Well, I think hopefully organics and organic fertilizer and just generally organic products become more of like a norm on campus when it comes to the green, especially with the campus down in Lewis. We are hoping to use organics down there and educate the public down there, especially because we're so close to the water. Getting that in our oceans is just not good. And it's not good to get anywhere.
Back to Sophie. I asked her what she has learned and hopes to pass on to CJ.
I think I learned that it's a lot harder than you think it's going to be. Because to me, something like this just makes sense. Changing a system to make it more environmentally friendly and safer for everybody. I think in my head, I thought Grounds was going to be a lot more into this and they were going to accept it and be willing to change. But once I talked to them, I realized they didn't really have the energy or want to use the energy to make a change or to train their workers to do something different. Even though it's a lot easier than what they were doing before, it just takes that small amount of effort to make that difference, and they didn't want to do that. So I think changing the minds of people like that who are super set in their ways and they're almost, I'd say, afraid to change, I think that was the most surprising to me.
Sounds familiar. Climate advocates experience the same resistance in trying to get people to consider climate solutions. So what did Sophie learn about herself during her time greening the green?
I'm extremely persistent. with this, you kind of have to be. If you're chair of Green the Green, Grounds is not going to listen to you. They're automatically not going to like you. If you make a meeting with them, they'll come in and they'll be mean to you right off the bat, even if you haven't done anything except be polite to them. So I think I learned how to not take things like that to heart and to just stay with what I believe in and know that this is extremely important and I need to be persistent with it.
Persistence. Seems this message got communicated to CJ. I asked CJ if she had any advice to give herself and to climate advocates.
Yeah, I guess like staying persistent, and if something knocks you down, get back up and try something different. Just keep trying to change and evolve and not let small things get you down.
Sophie, CJ, and the other students at University of Delaware, past and present, seek to change something in the system that will positively affect everyone. To do so, they are documenting all of their steps for future students. These steps can serve as a template when new issues come up that they need to address. What I love about this story is how it models what many of us are trying to do on a very large scale: change how we get our energy as we pursue climate solutions. Beyond individual changes, we pursue systems change. The college campus is the perfect training ground for this sort of work. The successes the students and campus community achieve not only help the university, the students involved also walk away with knowledge about how to change a system. They then can carry that knowledge to their municipality, their state or province, and even to the national level. Here's an example. Education campaigns, presentations about cost analysis, and persistence has already succeeded in bringing significant changes to campuses. Due to the work of sustainability offices and environmental students, many campuses now have dining halls that are trayless. Instead of carrying the food around on big trays, students carry it in their hands. This one change, getting rid of the trays, has had a massive impact. It reduces food waste by 25 to 30%. It also saves an extraordinary amount of water and energy needed to wash these trays. One systems change, and everyone in the community, for years to come, conserves more. Sure, it takes longer, much longer, to change a system, but the payoff is often immense. I have no doubt, one day, the University of Delaware will have an organic lawn. The admissions office will boast about it to prospective students. Thanks to Sophie and CJ and the folks who came before and probably will come after, people will know about that big change and how it came about. Want to know more about Green the Green? CJ explains how.
You can follow us on Facebook and Instagram. It's just Students for, like the number four, the environment.
You can also follow them on Twitter at S4EUD. That's the letter S, the number four, EUD. It stands for Students for the Environment, University of Delaware. I will be sure to have links in the show notes over at citizensclimatelobby.org/blog. Now, it is time for the Art House. In the USA, one of the most dramatic encounters happens every year around the Thanksgiving holiday table. In his play, Dad, theater student Dante Flores decided to magnify the tension.
It's the story of one family's Thanksgiving against the backdrop of accelerationism, by which I mean like ecological acceleration, accelerating the effects of climate change, accelerating until the moment where we completely destroy ourselves atomically.
I met Dante at Theater in the Time of Climate Change in Boston, Massachusetts. It was sponsored by HowlRound and Emerson College. During a break, Dante and I stepped outside and he told me about his new play and the playwriting process.
The most interesting part of the process for me is how the play as like a thing travels from being one crystallized image in my head to becoming a series of questions that I'm asking about a given topic. I start out with a single image or a few lines of dialogue or something that I have in my head or a moment that I want to build to. And then the interesting part for me is discovering the play around it and finding what lives in the same neighborhood for me as that moment.
Dante found inspiration for his play during the first American Thanksgiving after the 2016 U.S. presidential election. The country seemed more divided than ever. Suddenly, people from all political persuasions gathered together for extended family time and intimate conversation. Dante reminded me of another tense standoff happening at the very same time.
That first Thanksgiving afterwards was really weird for me because that was also when all the Standing Rock stuff was happening. I was just thinking a lot about, like, what right do we have to celebrate Thanksgiving when there are people against whom water is being weaponized?
Dante sets his play at Thanksgiving during a time of climate change. Then he increases the drama even more.
Yeah, it's how this family deals with the death of a family member. I won't say which one. For me, what I'm curious about is how to go about rituals when a key part of those rituals is missing or when it doesn't make sense to celebrate that ritual anymore. How do you celebrate Thanksgiving when an instrumental family member has died? What are the implications of rituals that don't make sense anymore politically and ecologically? And like, as we move toward collapse, like, what is the purpose of ritual?
This death sounds like a metaphor for mourning something substantial and central in our own lives, a stable environment and weather systems. In order to immerse his characters and the audience in this experience, Dante structures his play with a repeat loop.
And it's the same Thanksgiving dinner repeating over and over again. As the dinner repeats, you know, language starts to break down, the play starts to break down, the family's relationships start to break down until they're only, like, characters who can enter and exit the space at will and, like, who can manipulate the conventions of the play around them until they reach a satisfactory conclusion, whether it's a successful dinner or everyone's dead. As climate change moves, as the effects of climate change move forward, people will become, or perhaps already are, as disposable as the goods they consume. There's one line in there kind of towards the end. It's, there's no essential difference between the living and the dead.
As the play progresses, the characters begin to see what is happening. This reminds me of Bill Murray's character in the film Groundhog Day. Murray plays a big city reporter sent to central PA to cover a silly local event. He then gets stuck in the same day on repeat. In doing so, he discovers what is really important in his life.
Do you ever have deja vu, Mrs. Lancaster?
I don't think so, but I could check with the kitchen.
As an artist concerned about climate change, Dante wants to push his audience to see we are responsible for the problem of climate change.
And when I say we, I do mean, yeah, sure, us as individual citizens who could probably recycle, have recycled all the Coke cans that we throw away, but also, like, which politicians we support and what policies are we okay with, what policies are we not informed on. Those, to me, all fall under the umbrella of doing things the way we've been doing them.
If you want to follow Dante Flores as he begins his career in theater, you can do so over at Twitter, @dainty_flowers. Wow, I really love that handle. That Twitter again, @dainty_flowers. If you have an idea for the Art House, feel free to contact me, radio@citizensclimate.org. Now, it is time for our Citizens Climate Radio Puzzler Question. This month, I repeat the puzzler question from last month and give you a little bit more time to get back to me. Here's the question. You're talking with your neighbor, Tabitha. She seems interested in your work as a climate advocate. You tell her about large solutions like carbon fee and dividend. You're so excited to find someone who wants to know more. But then you notice Tabitha's eyes start to glaze over. She interrupts you. This all sounds so important and overwhelming. But what does it mean for you and for me? Tabitha wants to better understand climate change. She doesn't need more facts right now. She needs to hear some more of your own story. How might you begin to shift the tone and get personal with her? What does climate change mean for you? Let's get personal. Send me your answers, leave your name, contact info, and where you're from. Get back to me by October 15th, 2018. You can email your answers to radio@citizensclimate.org. That's radio@citizensclimate.org. Or leave me a voicemail of 3 minutes or less. And don't be anxious about the voicemail. You can leave as many versions of your answer as you like. If you stumble, just try again until you feel comfortable with your answer. Leave your message at the following number, 518-595-9414, +1 if calling from outside the USA. That number again, 518-595-9414. Thank you so much for joining me for another episode of Citizens Climate Radio. Feel free to contact me with your thoughts and ideas. The show is written and produced by me, Peter Santoscano. Other technical support from Ricky Bradley and Brett Cease. Social media assistance from Ashley Hunt Monterano, Flannery Winchester, Allison Kubisco, and Steve Volk. Moral support from Madeline Pera. All the music we use on the show is licensed unless otherwise specified. Special music for the Art House segment includes One Suite from the free 1920s collection on archive.org. I'd love it if you share Citizens Climate Radio with your friends. You can find us wherever you listen to podcasts, including iTunes, Podbean, SoundCloud, TuneIn, and Stitcher Radio. You can also listen at northernspiritradio.org. Join the discussion at our Facebook group page, facebook.com/groups/citizensclimateradio. And you can follow us on Twitter @CitizensCRadio. That's Citizens, the letter C, Radio, @CitizensCRadio. Visit citizensclimatelobby.org/blog to see info about our puzzler and find links to our guest. Citizens Climate Radio is a project of Citizens Climate Education.